everyone, and welcome back to the Dog Show Drive with Wayne and Will. I'm Wayne.
And I'm Wayne's friend, Will.
we've made it a little shorter. We've dropped the surnames. We have a good show for you tonight. I hope you enjoy it. We're going to be talking about a scientific experiment that you'll hear I'm not real fond of, about the links between behavior and breed. Yep. We're going to talk about judging those opportunities to see many dogs and how much it means to the template in your mind, all that and more on the Dog Show Drive.
I'm born to run down rocky cliffs. Give me grace, bury my sins. Shattered glass and black holes can't hold me back from where I need to go. Oh,
oh. Well, good morning there, young William. How the heck are you, bud?
Oh, I'm exhausted, Wayne.
I am too.
Three overtimes last night with that Rangers Penguin.
What are they doing to us? We're old men. We can't take these midnight games.
And then there was a report that because the Penguins goaltender pulled a muscle or a groin. And the third goalie had to come out for the last overtime. And he was all upset because he had something to eat in between periods. He had spicy pork and something. So he was worried about that all his periods.
That's funny. Well, he only played in two NHL games, I think, or some crazy low number. Or maybe two playoff games. And it was two playoff games, but
can you not many appearances? Because you think you're not doing anything, so I guess they have a spread in their dressing. You just start down and down, and then, by the way, you're up. Sitting there for 4 hours.
Steve used to tell us that as soon as it went to overtime, they ordered a bunch of pizzas, you know, and had them just laying around so you could at least get some carbs.
Get the strength back, especially after third overtime. Jeez, but not the goaltender.
And IVs and everything else. Jeez, what a mess. Anyway, big time coming up in hockey. And Toronto, the Leafs, huh?
Oh, I know, man.
Big win. 5-0.
Yeah.
Looking good doing
it. Back-to-back champions. Yep.
Killing off some serious tough power plays on one of the best in the league. Yeah. That's going to be quite the now, I wish they were different colors because the night goes on, you know, the blue and the white, you just get make somebody wear red or purple or something. Exactly. Why not purple, red? Too confusing. Or maybe red helmets and green helmets. That would be nice.
Good thing we don't have Jake Gardner anymore. We'd be passing all over the place.
That's right. Sorry. You get a puck. Like Oprah, you get a puck.
I thought it was my guy. I'm sorry.
Everybody gets a puck. Well, you know, they'd be calling for it too from
him. Oh, yeah. Jake, over here. Okay.
Well, a little bird tells me that they have a special guest coming to the Leafs game tomorrow night.
Oh, yeah. Actually, when this airs, it'll be last night. So,
And that young celebrity is none other than William Alexander.
Yeah, you know, I was invited to the game. I'm going to hopefully do some speaking. No, I'm going to be just sitting in the crowd eating crappy food and just acting like an idiot.
And just say, you'll have the foam finger. You'll have the whole thing. The foam finger, the jersey, the hat backwards.
I'm not excited at all. So,
quite the score getting tickets for that one.
Oh, I've already got my jersey up, hanging, straightening out. I have my, you know, the hoodie I usually wear.
Yeah.
But I wear that for every game.
Oh.
So now, and it's got no wrists, right? So
that's the best part. Yeah.
So, but I'm going to put it underneath my jersey and just put the hoodie over top and then pull the hoodie out. And then,
What about the hat? Won't that get covered by the hoodie?
No, I'm going to pull it out. My hat. Yeah. I haven't decided if I'm going to wear the hat or not, but I might bring my toque. Just in case it gets chilly.
That's right. You got to keep your wigwam. That's right. Well, enjoy.
Just another.
Yeah. Welcome to the hockey show with Wayne
Will. Yep. Coach's corner.
Yeah. Please. Anyway, there's a dog thing. I don't know where you get it or. But I can tell you it was on the Today Show here in America. It was on the New York Times. It was in every media outlet down here. And it just really, Will, I didn't like it very much. It's a study.
You'll have to let me know what it is.
It's a study by the University of Massachusetts. Not that I want to blame the university, but somehow this Catherine Lord and Kathleen Morrell or something like that, and others have been running the study for a long time. And their conclusion with animal behavior concerning canines is that the breed of the dog only has 9%, the behavior of a dog only has 9% to do with its breed. Now, that's hysterical, Will. That's not science. That's just stupid. And I'll tell you why, Will. I will tell you why.
I'm holding on.
Seriously, I read a whole lot of science. It's my jam. I love especially genetics. And this is a genomics program they run at UMass. It was self-reported. Any study that's self-reported, to me, goes right in the circular file. And especially in this case. How many pet owners and dog owners, first of all, the data was collected over years by submitting a DNA swab and a questionnaire. So no one saw any dogs. No behaviorist examined the dogs. This is self-reported. So the very people who dress up their dogs for holidays and put things on their head, Will, these are the people who reported the behavior of their dogs to this scientific study. And the other thing is they use DNA swabs to identify how much breed characteristics they have, because they use a lot of crossbred dogs in the study. People sent everything in. And they, as if DNA identifies breeds for sure. It does not. It's a novelty. Don't give me that. Beep. It doesn't. It's just not. So in this study, well, let's put it this way. Let's do this. Let's send DNA swabs and questionnaires to young couples with babies. And they can report the baby's behavior. I can tell you what it's going to say. Really smart, really curious, always wanting to learn, the best baby ever. That's how they're going to describe their baby's behavior. This woman is saying things like a Siberian and a Golden both can fetch. Well, yeah, they can. Which one wants to do it repeatedly? You know, and there's so many more of those moronic assumptions that it just, I can't tell you. I can't believe. And this is what really,
you can tell us.
This is what really bothers me. Well, there's many things in the study, but the media, this is palatable, right? People love this shit stuff. They love hearing that there's no relationship between a breed and its behavior because they think they can understand that and they believe it. Like a bunch of lemmings is what they are, Will. So the media picks it. Now, James Serple has done brilliant studies. He is a behavioralist at Penn. Stephen Zolotowski, one of the brilliant scientists of our time, a very dear friend of mine. He was the chief scientist at ASPCA. He's the one who actually went and graded all the Michael Vick dogs so they didn't all get to put to sleep and found them home because he knows how to grade behavior. He's a behaviorist with a PhD in it, not some pet owner with Busy Bee and his Weimaraner telling me how it behaves. That's just ridiculous science. It makes zero sense. Self-reporting in itself in any scientific paper or journal can be acceptable in certain circumstances. But when you have people not reporting on themselves, which alone is bad enough, reporting on a dog while they're observing and they don't even know when the dog needs to take a pee, it pees on the, we can pick that up from 3 hours before it's going to pee, right? You'll be sitting at somebody's house and you go, that dog needs to pee. What do you mean? Shh. And there it goes, right? We know all that. We know when you're walking a dog, we know all the little signals and signs. They didn't ask us, Will. And I don't even have any, I'll bet the purebred dogs that they thought they had were purebred probably weren't. And if they were, they're probably from some mix of undecided heritage that came through some pet shop or something. Damn it.
Dressed up like Busy Bee.
Exactly. Are you going to tell me that a beagle's behavior is determined by 9% of its DNA, breed-specific, breed-related DNA? okay, let's go out to the field and play fetch with a beagle and a golden retriever. You're never going to see the beagle after the first throw. He's gone.
He won't come back.
He'll never come back.
Food bowl with you. He's not coming back.
But while you're sleeping that night, that damn golden will be dropping wet balls on your bed. He's going to keep bringing them back. This is inherent ingrained behavior determined by selective breeding and the breed. And what they're missing about it is, yes, a Siberian may be able to fetch and a golden may be able to howl like a Siberian, as they talk about in the journal. By the way, I read the full study. I got it from Zolotowski, the retired chief scientist at the A and the Michael Vick guy. He sent me the entire report, which is even more unbelievable. But when what they misunderstand is that, for example, retrievers, Labradors are going to bring you the ball. They're bred to get the duck and bring it back, right? That's what they do. But it's far more than what they do that determines their behavior. It's not just that they fetch, because a Siberian can fetch. It's that their world surrounds it to the point where their personality, their behavior is, what can I do for you? What can I bring you? What can I get you? What can I do for you? I'm watching you all the time saying, how can I make you happy? It's not just the fetch. It's the whole zen that surrounds that behavior that makes them the behavior that is their behavior of the whole dog. And to miss this and have some genomics experts out there collecting data from the busy bee owners about their damn Weimaraner at Best in Show with that wonderful group in Parker Posey in Best in Show movie, that is. Come on. Burn it, damn it. Horrible science. Horrible. I don't know if the AKC responded. But if they did, I just hope it said hearty har har and LOL symbols with little tears, because that's just brutal. So yeah. So when you go to buy a dog, remember this. This is published science in a journal called Science, done at UMass, that you remember when you buy a dog now, don't worry about the breed. They're all the same. Only 9% of their DNA determines their behavior. So you just go out there and buy any dog, they'll all have the same behavior except a little bit of 9%. Come think about that. Cane of Corso. I guess size is an issue, right? So let's be fair and say size. A Mastiff and a Cane Corso, they're different. Big size dogs, right? Working dogs. They're just different in their behavior and what they do. Ah, man. Give me a break.
So that means we could, in reality, if we were shepherds, we could take our beagle and they could guard our flock.
Exactly.
If it's only 9%, we could get
Think about that. 9%. I can train that part, right? Exactly. Yeah. Let's have the beagles would just wait around for the sheep to be getting fed and they'd steal all their food. It would be very simple. The beagle would weigh 900 pounds in 1 week and explode like a tick.
Oh, yeah. The only way to get mad at the coyote is if the coyote was trying to get their food bowl.
That's right. That could be.
Maybe if we tried food bowls to all the sheep, they might be protected.
I just can't believe this. And what bothers me most is that the media picked up on the story and ran with it. Now, I know how these journals work and these studies work. I've been involved in them. And I'm sure that Dr. Moss had a really good PR agent. And Dr. Marl and Lord. Oh, Dr. Lord. She must know everything.
What grinds my gears with Wayne Kavanaugh?
But, the shame of it is that there's really good science out there that would help dog owners. It would help people shopping for a dog. Heaven forbid they buy a purebred dog, right? And there's a premise, an underlying premise in my head that thinks, I know where this team stands when it comes down to rights, animal welfare. But it just seems so biased and so unreliable. It's disturbing. So I hope all you scientists out there that are dog breeders and dog owners understand how this upsets me because of the self-reported data and report, and because of the DNA. So, so anyway, that's my rant for the day. But it does, it does beg the question, why can't we get good scientific papers into the mainstream media? I think the reason is because the people who, there's two reasons. One, we're just not smart enough to read that stuff and understand it. I guess that's the assumption. And the other is that maybe Penn and some of these great universities that deal with behavior on an incredible level. By the way, you know, Serples, Serples, really serious science for 25 years, one of his many programs. And James is not only a friend, he's just a, the guy's world renowned as the behavioralist, as many others are. Mm-hmm. I wish Malcolm Willis was alive from England to dissect this stupid study. But there's, you know, he has a wonderful study about spaying and neutering, how we all think it stops dogs from biting and fighting and all that. It's a bunch of bullshit. It doesn't work that way. And this guy knows what he's doing. He's a behavioralist, not a, oh boy. Whew. I guess I'm not over this, Will.
No, you're not. And I like it. I like this kind of content.
Anyway, well, try to find the paper if you can. It's usually something about success. Your breed doesn't matter at the headline. But yeah, if you just Google dog behavior, breed specific or breeds, I'm sure any of those words will call it up because there's 1,000 places that printed it. You can just let it roll.
You tell the handler that's showing up a brown Labrador, chocolate Labrador, that is not a trait.
Yeah. Huh? About that. And by the way, we know how subtle these behaviors are. Does a black and tan Minpin exactly look like and behave like a red one? There are people that would argue that there are subtle differences. That's true in most. How about a party color cocker and a solid black?
Totally. Yeah. Oh my God, the difference is incredible. Like even the varieties, I mean the colors in standard poodles.
Yeah.
There's definite differences in each color.
We're talking about the colors within a breed. They can't even determine a breed. That's how lame this study is. Jeez, I don't know. But it is true, and you know, it's true that we just don't get the right science to the masses, and I'm not sure if it's a matter of good science is too hard to digest in our microwave memory retention world, you know, the microwave world. I don't know, Will. It just burns my newspaper. Anyway, you've been to shows that have dogs that behave like their breeds, don't you, Will? Haven't you, Will?
Yeah, I was at a show on the weekend in Lindsay. Lindsay, Ontario hosts a lot of dog shows now in Ontario. It's kind of like our Springfield now. It's Springfield, Mass. There's a Lindsay Fairgrounds, and they have a lot of dog shows there. And it's a great site. It really is. And there's great restaurants and good hotels, and it's works out. It was a nice show. I think they made the mistake. The Victoria County Kennel Club, they had it limited for the first 2 days, and which means only 200 dogs per show, 2 shows a day. I think they weren't thinking. I think if they'd stuck with just 3 shows, they would have got 400 to 500 dogs a day. There was that many people that wanted to be there. And the Sunday that wasn't limited, it got almost 400 dogs. Well, think about all the people that just didn't bother going for 1 day. So,
right. Yeah.
And they really missed the boat.
You know, 400 and 500 dog shows, I know that doesn't sound big anymore, but we sure have plenty of them here still.
Well, up in Canada, that's a good size show.
Yeah.
Because of our sheer population. Mm-hmm. But the limited dog shows are put in for areas that were remote to have dog shows. Well, Lindsay, Ontario was not remote. It's a dog show site that we go to at least once a month. You know, it's there all the time. And so I think they've got to stop this and put it back to where it's supposed to be, to remote areas to have their limited shows.
And remind us Americans what your definition of a limited show is.
It's 200 dogs a day. 200 dogs a show, 2 shows a day.
Right. We're here. We just, that means the club sets, we're only going to take so many entries, right?
Well, Bob Whitney made a good point. He said, if one day over the weekend, if they have to not accept up to 100 entries, they should not be allowed to have limited shows anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because if they can't even reach it, that's a very good point.
Well, and there are shows, like there were shows, I think, Northern Ontario, that were 100 dogs. Well, that's a remote area, and two shows a day there would make sense for them, because at least then they have 200 dog entries. But to have a show in an hour and a half outside of Toronto, a limited show, that's pushing it. So.
Yeah. Well, of course, we had our infamous 100 dog show in New Mexico last year with one terrier entered.
Yeah.
So, you know, by the way, for those who are taking notes, which means probably none of you.
You're driving, Wayne.
Because you're driving, I hope. It's the UMass Chan, C-H-A-N study. And the Chan is, that's a person's name that studied. It's the name of the school within UMass. It's the UMass Chan Medical School genetic study of more than 2,000 purebred and mixed breed dogs published in the magazine Science. But if you just put UMass Chan study or dog behavior UMass, it's going to come up, because I'm scrolling through and I'm telling you, it's been covered in everything. NBC, Nature Magazine, The Today Show, CBS News, Fox News, Smithsonian Magazine, NPR. I'm not kidding. This is how many places picked this up. The Atlantic, The Scientist, Wall Street Journal, The Guardian. It just goes on, you know. Yeah.
So it got out there. So
it's all over. All over. So anyway, you know, we've had discussions about judging. Well, and I know we've been talking about the most recent shows in your area. I don't think it's any particular thing in your area, but not what you're expecting.
Well, what the problem
seems, again, we're not being critical of any
particular. No, because you can only do what you can do. But what we're having problems with up here is, especially with for the new judges, not with the new judges, but for the new judges, with a bunch of singleton entries, they're just handing out ribbons. They're not getting, like you said, a template in their head of what they should be looking for. And how can you expect them to when the shows they're judging is ribbon 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 1. It's so hard to expect them to not, I think a lot of them do a good job, but it's hard for them to create that kind of depth, that consistent good job when they don't get to judge dogs and they don't get to judge the numbers in a certain breed.
You don't have the opportunity to form those templates.
Right.
Yeah. I think, you know, people will say working for handlers that had a good string, you know, fortunate, a lot of us were worked at the University of Forsyth. We didn't just have 100 dogs. We had 100 really good ones, and they were the best ones of each breed. We'd win all the groups sometimes.
Right.
These are talking about 2,000 dog, 3,000 dog shows too. So to see and touch and groom and bathe and prepare those dogs every weekend, you're looking at really good dog flesh and really unique, typical dogs for their breed. And when you have that opportunity over a number of years to see depth and quality in numbers, it helps you form your template. When you don't get enough dogs to judge, especially 10 good specials to really work through,
exactly,
it's hard to sharpen your focus. So, you know, at the end of the day, those templates truly are essential. And it does take seeing lots of good dogs. That's why nationals are so important to go to. But if you don't have the opportunity, you can go through life judging for 30 years and never have the chance to have to dig in.
Right. And you see that all the time. You'll see them. And to, you know, put some support with these guys, they will tend to stick with dogs they know. But I find they will miss dogs because they don't know to find that dog. They don't know that they, not that they don't know, it's just they don't have the template in their head to find certain things. Right. It's just a worry, especially because we've been shut down so much with the pandemic. We have been not resorted to just Canadian judges, but we found localized judges. And mm-hmm. the newer judges, they're not able, our numbers went down for the pandemic, so it was even worse for them. You know, they were stuck mm-hmm. with 1-1-1-1-1-1-1.
Yeah.
And no, I don't want to talk poorly about them because it's not their fault. It's not their fault the entry is that way.
Well, this was quite a while ago, but we talked about an analogy that I had saying that when you get your driver's license, you take all the tests, you pass all the exams, you get the road test and everything, and you start driving. Are you as good as you are 15, 10, 20 years later when you've had the experience?
Right.
Then the next level of that, which applies here, is did that 10, 15 years of experience happen on the open plain somewhere where you had no traffic around you and straight roads with very few intersections, no clover leaves or highways? Or did it happen in Atlanta or LA or New York where you had to drive, learn to drive in a lot of company? So a lot of quality and depth and a lot of bad quality and depth, all of which is important. So it's the same sort of thing. You know, it's not just how long you've been judging. It's how thick was the traffic when you were judging.
It makes good right? sense, right? It's like when I was a kid, I grew up in a rural area, and we all tried to take our driver's license test in Port Perry, which was a small little town. Well, yep. There's no traffic there.
Exactly. So,
but
yeah, that's it's no one's fault. It's just the way it is. And well, in my opinion, everything's to blame on too many shows, not enough entries. And that is true. You know, if we had fewer shows and bigger entries, you'd sort out the wheat from the chaff real quick.
Right.
So I don't know. We do have many judges, lovely people who got all the questions right on the exams, who took all the credits they need to take, did all the seminars and studies, and still just aren't comfortable putting anything up that didn't win the day before.
Right. Another question comes up. This is a good question because of your background at UKC. A friend of mine who is a judge as well, she doesn't judge a lot. She judges like 5 or 6 times a year, but she's the parenting kennel club does not allow them to take assignments at ABI, UKC, any of these shows.
That's silly.
Yeah, and they want the experience. They want the experience of getting in the ring, and even just for their own procedure, just getting comfortable with procedural things and how they're going to judge, how they're going to run their rings, and they're not allowed to.
I always thought the UKC was a good minor league. You know, it was a good way to learn to judge. And
well, it came to me secondhand, but I think it's something I'm going to address with some of my friends that are in directors or whatnot, because why not make them like a minor league? These judges need the experience. How do we expect them to go? It's like going from, let's go back to a hockey analogy.
Yeah.
they play 6 games in the NHL. If they didn't have the AHL to fall back on, how would they ever improve?
Yeah.
You know,
oh, you came out of high school, did you? Well, let's go play for the Rangers tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, and the silly thing about it is you would guess that the reasoning would be, whether it be discussed or not, is there's some jealousy in the IABC or whoever is going to take over the CKC. It's never going to happen. That was always the silly thing about the AKC being so upset with me in the UKC. I mean, do you think we're going to take over? You think people are going to burn their UKC, their AKC papers and only go to UKC shows? I mean, it's nonsense. Oh. You know, you want that minor league. In fact, in hockey, you know, the NHL teams go out of their way to work with the AHL and support the AHL and send players back and forth to make sure they're ready when they come up to the show. It should be just the opposite. You should root for a minor league and have it. people love it. People love the minor league games in baseball and hockey and everything else. And then dog shows, I guess. And we don't have match shows anymore. No. No one's putting on those 500 dog matches like we used to have.
And even if they did have matches, do you think a licensed judge is going to go judge the match? Probably not. You know,
they should.
They should, of course, but
and they wouldn't.
Exactly, yeah. But they need them. They knew. I call it mileage. They need the mileage. Even with my guy, I have young dogs, and I don't get them out. I said they've got to come out. They need the mileage on them. Mm-hmm. Be ready for what I want them to do in the future. It's the same with a judge, as far as I'm concerned. They need that mileage in the ring and have their hands on as many dogs as they can.
Yeah, I can make a beautiful custom guitar, and it's not going to sound good for a year if you play it. If you stick it on the wall, it's never going to open up. It's never going to have that resonance of that top soundboard bouncing just a little bit to pump that sound out. And
is there anything you can't do, Wayne?
Ballet, very bad at ballet. I think my ballet is pretty funny. Makes young people laugh, but I can't. Well, anyway, but that's the way that works. The whole geometry of that and the sound science of that is pumping that sound out. It looks like a guitar just stays or it doesn't. And in tiny little subtle motions, that soundboard on the top of the guitar has got to be built enough to have some suppleness. It's an amplifier. It's pumping the sound out the sound hole, and without opening it up and playing it, it's not going to get any better. And you're not going to get better as a guitar player unless you play every day, right? So it's the same thing judging. Unless you're out there doing it, screwing it up, whatever, just doing it until you get better at it. You know, there's breeds that I just sent an application in for, actually put it in the mailbox, and it was received. Finally, I did that. Those breeds, to me, I feel extremely comfortable. I don't think I'm going to have to go there, but my next application is going to have breeds on there that I can do as good as anybody else. Not good enough for me. I'm probably going to be better 20 shows in than I am the first show, at least in my mind, with confidence. And what happens when you don't have that confidence and experience, you fall back on the magazines and whoever won the Thursday before. And that's just the way our system works now. And, it's just, you know, English judges get a couple hundred dogs to judge every time they judge. I'm not saying they're better or worse, but I'm just saying it's different.
They're thrown into the fire and they have to, to make it work. They have to go through.
Seminars are great, but you're looking at six dogs that somebody bought for a couple hours and it's not the same.
No, it's not. So I really hope there's a way around it because these judges do need their mileage put on them to. Like I've judged quite a few. I judged quite a few shows for you. I've judged a bunch of shows up here before I even wrote my CKC test. And
yeah.
So it's
beneficial. Yes.
It was beneficial to me.
And just doing the Irish Setter National. How much did you learn from that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, by the way, you know, and this happens a lot. It's wonderful that breed clubs will say, you know what, we're going to get a breeder who's not approved to judge or a handler is not approved to judge. And we're going to write that letter and get it done so they can judge our national. That's great. I really do. I think it's great. But you can get, when you walk in there, and there's an intimidation factor of just filling out the paperwork and knowing where you are in the ring and sorting through so many dogs. And by the way, if you're in there because you're a breeder or handler of that breed, you know all the dogs and where they came from and who owns them, what their pedigrees are. Your head is spinning. And without the practice of judging at smaller shows, you walk in and do 200 or 300 or something. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a wake-up call. It doesn't always work out. And I'm not saying those judges aren't going to be great down the road, but it is like going down the street, picking up somebody playing hockey in the street and saying, hey, do you want to start for the you want to start for the Leafs in round one tomorrow?
Yeah, that'd be like a Zamboni driver playing net. Oh, wait, that did happen. And he beat us. Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, that's bad true. Example. There is that. Wouldn't it be fun if they found the nice Finnish goaltender names? Well, maybe an Italian goaltender named Zamboni and signed them for the team. It would be great. But, so, yeah, it's difficult. And again, You need a million tools in your toolbox. You need to have the luck of working for somebody that had a lot of good dogs. You need to have the luck of growing up in the sport, if that's possible. You need to have the luck of going to field events if you're judging sporting dogs, and lure coursing events if you're judging sighthounds, and so on and so forth, karting, whatever it might be. And then going to a lot of shows, seeing a lot of good dogs, and talking to a lot of mentors. I had several calls, refreshing, in the last couple of weeks, of people who called me to ask questions about breeds I've been closely involved in. They already were approved for that, those breeds. They weren't looking for a CEU. They were looking for another opinion.
Right.
Because they got in the ring and they judged them once or twice, and they said, wait a second, now that I see it and apply it, my two mentors were just pimping their own kennels. What's the real essence of this breed? And, you know, you got to make those calls. Don't stick with just because you're not getting points for it. That's it. You got to try to find out from someone whose head's been wrapped around a particular breed for a long time.
That's a good point, because that comes down to experience. Because if it were you and you were bombarded with these two breeders, you would take what you would from both breeders, but you would see through it and come up with your own conclusion. Where it's hard for someone that's not, doesn't have that kind of experience to do that. You know, they're going to lean towards what they've just been taught, which is probably good beneficial education. But if it is swayed to what they produce themselves, it's hard to clean out that mess in your head.
There's a reason that universities make you take prerequisite courses before you start on your specialty. You need a bottom line foundation, a base for which, because you can't, it's hard to learn the other stuff without having a foundation. It might not be specifically related, but at least to get your brain thinking that way. And I love talking dogs anyway, but I really like it when someone's interested in, I can look at some, you know, involved in more than a couple of breeds, unfortunately or fortunately. And when I look at the mentor list, I'm like, I know those people and they're really good. This guy is going to tell you something completely different from this one, because he's been breeding look like this for 40 years. This guy's been breeding for 40 years look like this. And if you only called one of them or called both and didn't question it and try to find your own focus, your own pinpoint, your own end of the tunnel, swing and a miss. You'll be guessing for quite a while.
Yep. For sure. And
especially when they both walk in the ring a month later, knowing you mentored them, and they each bring that dog that they tell you was the great one, and you have to sort that out. This whole mentoring and then showing to you, that's a sticky wicket, Will. It's a sticky wicket.
But, you know, but you have to have, like an instance came up to me this weekend where a certain dog is doing quite a bit of winning. Someone was trying to tell me how this dog wasn't as good as it appears to be. And you've got to, you know, you have to have some confidence in yourself to say, no, wait a second, I've seen that dog and mm-hmm. you're wrong. You're wrong. Yeah. You can tell me all those things you want, but you're wrong. In my eye, I see why this dog is being successful. And it's not just because it's owned by so-and-so or advertised by so-and-so.
Yeah.
This dog has qualities. So you're not going to sit there and tell me it doesn't.
We were at the Pointer National, Paul and Eichel, Marjorie and I sitting together, Marjorie Mortarella. And there's about 200 years of pointer experience there. And we all really like this particular pointer. And we just laughed all weekend watching other people in the breed just rip this dog apart. And we're thinking, well, you know, I don't know. I think maybe we know something about the breed and we like this pointer a lot. So, maybe we're wrong. I don't know. And different opinions do make the world go round. We need those, like we talk about all the time, we need bad judges so people keep coming back. But it's an interesting sport. It's a completely subjective sport. Zero objectivity at the end of the day. It's a sport of opinions.
Yeah.
How many sports are just opinions? You know what horse
crap. You're skating.
Yeah, well, that's true. There is an element, a big element of subjectivity there, but I don't know. There's also things you've got to do when they know which to do and check them off and get points for them. You know, horse racing, we know who wins them. Hockey games, we know who wins them. Baseball, I mean, tennis, what other sport? They go, it was a good game, but in my opinion, I thought that, you know, the Tigers should have won that game. So that's
what they win.
They won. Yeah. I've been studying baseball for 20 years. I've taken all the credits. I know all the exams. And I say, even though it's 6-0, that they win. That's what I say. It's my opinion. I am a judge of highly qualified stature. And I say they win, even though they lost 6-0. You know, there's no sport like ours.
You find competition and egos get in the way of facts sometimes. So, and you've got to clear your mind and It is difficult when even when I was showing dogs full time, and I was if I was having a hard time against a certain dog, it was actually Garrett Lambert that said, "Sit down and look at that dog, yeah. William. Look at that dog and figure it out. You know, you're not seeing it because you're shadowed. You're upset because it's not your dog that's winning. But take a look and see what that dog exactly is."
Not that there's not exceptions.
Oh yeah, for sure.
There have been top flight dogs that 99% of the people will say, that's just not a whatever. And they went anyway.
Yeah.
Good PR, good group, good team, good judges, and timing's good in that group. There's, you know, the competition's not strong, they get out. It happens, but I mean, most of the time, not most, I'd say all the time, the cream eventually rises to the top. And, you know, you might lose a few on the way. I just had a laugh when I had, not too long ago, I had someone say, well, didn't you like the number 4 or whatever? And I like the number none better. You know, there's, it just doesn't matter. You've got to have the courage to go in there and say, never seen that one before, but guess who's winning today?
Right. I remember winning a group under Michelle Billings. I won't say with what dog or breed or anything. And she told me the story. She went into the judge's room and some judge said, oh, why would you give that dog? It's not a great one. And she said, well, look around. It didn't need to be.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I had an occasion, this is a long time ago. I had the top winning dog, all breeds, was a Springer of Robbins. And Kelly walked in with a new dog. And no one ever seen it. It was his first show. It was a special. And I gave Kelly's dog the breed in a very hard fought competition, put the two next to each other. What I wanted to see, I saw more of in Kelly's dog than Robin's. Excellent dog. And that's how I did it. And people said, oh my God, you really went out on a limb. You know, did you just discovered this, discovered it? I had nothing to do with discovering it. Someone bred it and made it.
Right.
And it presented it beautifully. And it happened to be in my mind better on that day than the other one. Discovered anything. Nobody discovered anything. You know, I happened to pick a dog that I liked that day. And by the way, he went on to win Westminster. It was Diamond Jim. So it was a Diamond Jim in the rough at the moment. But
bing, bing. Sorry.
But how easy would it be to go,
right.
Close, but number one dog, you know. And you don't want to be that guy that just goes and beat. And by the way, Robin's a friend. I like this dog. I just like the other one better. You know, it's nothing to do with any of that. It's if you're hyper-focused on what you should be doing. And by the way, you're going to make big mistakes doing that too. Every judge regrets what they do at least once a show. You know, it could be a third and fourth. You go home going, you know, I should have switched that. So yeah, it's a matter of, it's just opinions and it's wonderful. And if you miss the big picture, which is the people and the fun and the camaraderie and the dogs, you need to find another sport.
Right.
Where are you going, Will? What you got coming up?
Well, I'm leaving for Quebec City tomorrow. I'm doing my third permit of the first half of the sporting group on Friday.
Well, that will do it, right?
That'll do it for the first half, and then I can.
Yeah, do you have enough dogs in competition? You know that ahead of time.
Yeah, but so I've already surpassed that. So even if just one dog shows up there, I just have to go there and do my thing. But I can't say for sure. But I think I've got about 60 dogs, so it's that's well past the number now. So
yeah, good. Well, that'll be fun.
Yep.
I talked to our buddy Doug. He's thinking about eventually getting into the judging arena, and so I think that sport deserves someone that's done what he's done in the sport. I think he'll have fun, and I hope more judges are thinking about it now, you know, more handlers that have maybe this opportunity of getting a whole group. Of course, I am truly happy about that because I have a lot of friends who qualify for that. Of course, it's us poor bastards who went and got a couple breeds too soon to qualify for it for a reason that makes zero sense to me.
Right.
Oh, you can't have the rest. You can only have a whole one. Okay, we'll take all the breeds away, and then I'll apply for the whole group. How's that work? Silly. Just silly. But anyway, yeah, I think that'll be fun. You know, the more people with background and distance in sport, and Doug's bred dogs too, you know. So it'll be fun to see how many people come forward and do that. And I hope this is the new process that the AKC is letting you apply for a whole group. It's not that easy. You've got to do things you've got to do, and you've got to keep records, and you've got to pass tests. And no one's giving
anything. They're not just handing you the sporting group or the half group. They're, you know, they want you to go through the process.
That's very well done, in my opinion. But I hope we get some more. Well, other than that, Will, I guess I've got to talk about it. It may be short.
Yeah.
Lost my buddy.
And the whole world knows because they followed along too. They know who you're talking about. So,
you know, he was our last podcast. He was, I remember even mentioning, you know, he's kind of really using that big old head to whack me to get my attention. And
he came over and he put his head on your shoulder and looked at me. Well, looked at the screen, but there he was. And,
the next day, took him for his long walk in the morning. He was fine. Midday, he was a little lame. By dinner time, he couldn't walk or stand. And we went to the ER vet, she was wonderful. She took x-rays and did blood work and said to me, I have pretty good news. He just has acute Lyme disease, and with doxycycline and anti-inflammatory and some pain meds, he'll be fine in a couple of days. And she took x-rays too. Well, it took four of us to get him in the car. And then it took four of us to get him out of the car at the vet's office. And then it took five to get him back in. And he's very compliant and trying. He's such a good boy. And, but you know, that's 200 pounds and 38 inches to move around. And we got home from the vet around 11 p.m. and I put our dog beds next to each other and slept next to him. And he was in just abject pain, you know, panting and looking at me with these pleading eyes. And at 2:30 in the morning, the vet called and woke us up and said, I wouldn't bother you, but he has osteosarcoma, unfortunately, very aggressive, highly aggressive, and it's in his femur. Well, you know, high up in the femur, a 200-pound dog, the pain is extraordinary. He couldn't stand to pee or poop or eat, and he was just in agony. So we laid there and cried for a few hours, and then when my bed opened, we went in, and she had read the x-rays as well and saw the obvious. And when I walked in, she just lost it. You know, she was our neighbor and she grew up this puppy too. And there's nothing she could do. 24 hours. Well, the world changed.
Yep. It's amazing what they do for us and what they do with us.
I can't count the number of dogs I've had. I mean, I guess I could if I had a long legal pad and a good memory. But, you know, this was the only dog. You know, we had the Beagle that Cheryl sort of was a party of, and Killy was mine. And, you know, we went everywhere together, and I don't know if it's just having that one-on-one and having, you know, we always had 10 dogs, 12 dogs. We were down to two, her Beagle, my Killian. And Cheryl, bless her heart, she's done so much for this dog when I'm away at shows or or whatever, you know, she has to do all the silly things I do with him every day. And, oh, he's just the biggest void. And in a little village, I mean, we got meals brought to the house, gift baskets and cards. And he was the village's dog, too.
Yeah, he impacted a lot of people. Yeah, even just the ones that contacted me to find out if you were okay or what happened. And it's just, yeah.
It was a special and time. Heartbreak breed. So worth every second. You know, he just... Oh, he was everything to me. We'd every morning I'd open one eye and I'd hear his tail would start going. Yeah. I opened the second eye and I'd hear and I'd get out of bed and walk over and he'd want his belly rubbed and he'd sing a big song. Sue Forsyth knows the songs he sang to her one afternoon quite loudly for quite a long time. He was just so special to me, Will. And, you know, so a tough one. I later find that his mother died of osteosarcoma at 4. And his sister just passed away. They were 6 years old. Killian was 6, and he was such a fit, athletic 6. People would say, gee, 197 is a lot of weight for a wolfhound. Well, when you're 38 inches tall and it's all rock hard muscle, because we walked miles every day. He had to go to the coffee window at Bigby's and cut in line and cut right the traffic, put his head on the counter for his cookie, please. And no one in our little village minded. They all knew he was coming for his cookie. And everywhere else he went, there was people sent me pictures of him at these craft beer gardens that Brody would take him to. And I'd forgotten all about it. And when he was a puppy, got him at 9 weeks, he and our beagle Olive, who was a puppy, our daughter's beagle Olive, who was a puppy, the two of them were inseparable. And there's lots of pictures of him with his arm around.
Oh, yeah. I followed along. Yeah.
And she came in the house and missed him. And it's been, boy, everything reminds me of him. Yep. And it's just, I didn't expect to take it this hard. It's been, you know, it'll be a week tomorrow. And I just didn't expect to take it. I mean, it was out of the blue, you know, fine 1 minute, gone the next. And it just too soon, too hard, too fast, and no preparation. You know, I just still think he's here.
Well, everybody's thinking about you, Wayne. So,
yeah, thanks.
Yep.
And if you're looking for a dog that will break your heart for sure, but make your every day better while they're around, there's nothing like an Irish Wolfhound. Their sensitivity, their intuition, their devotion, it's so unique. They're just like, I said to a friend, they're so human-like. And he said, they're what humans hope they're like.
Exactly.
But hope and wish they could be.
Right.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Thanks, everybody, for the hundreds and hundreds of thoughts and cards and letters. And for anybody that I don't even know if I've ever mentioned this, dog's never been to a dog show in his life, and everybody knows him. He was just the king of the town. I don't think it's bragging at all to say Will's seen him. Some great wolfhound breeders have seen him, and he would have been a group dog. He had a bite that looked like he ran into a fire hydrant, and his tail, when he was 7 months, he had a perfect tail. And at 7 months, he woke up and it went over his back. And I remember John Kelly, and by the way, I couldn't have been any happier because I didn't have to show him, no pressure.
Me too. I wasn't sure how I was going to show him.
You were going to show him. And he was a little bit, he would have looked really big.
Yeah.
You know, even Bill McFadden, he would still look big next to Bill McFadden showing him. But I was thrilled this tail went over his back, although I didn't want to look at it much, you know. I got used to it after a while. But it happens in wolfhounds. John Kelly from Nutstown told me that on their seventh birthday, you better watch for their tail in the morning. And of course, that's a good bit of Irish yarn around a fact. That's about when it happens. And he probably was 7 months and a week when it happened to him. And there's no breed that does it. There's no hereditary component that we can think of. It just happens. And in the Irish Wolfhound Bible, the Magnificent Irish Wolfhound by Mary McBride, by the way, it's the greatest breed book in the history of breed books. It's like an encyclopedia and it's brilliantly written. She talks about it. At 7 months, you're going to get it. So could I have finished him with a high tail?
Oh, for sure.
In 2 minutes.
He would have finished.
I'm not going to show a quality dog like that to people. And I know most judges, right? I'm not going to put them on the spot like that. And he was just as happy going to the car dealerships with me every Sunday and taking our walks and going everywhere with me and just hanging out and making little kids happy at the park. And I taught him, there's a giant cement pipe in the park. And one day I said, "Hey, Kelly, how about you run through the pipe and run back?" And, "Yeah, okay, I can do that." And so every time I went to the park, he had to run through the pipe and run back, and he got his cookie. He trained me very well. He was a great human trainer, one of the best human trainers in the world. But, man, I don't know, Will. I've never experienced a reaction this hard to anything, human or dog.
That's how special he was, though.
Yeah. He was so thrilled to have him, thrilled to have had him. And he's still with me. I can guarantee you that. His body might be gone, but he's still here. So there you have it. Thanks very much, everybody, for your thoughts and cards and emails and messages. It was overwhelming and greatly appreciated. All right, Will.
Stay safe out there, guys, and keep the special ones close.
Party on, Bert.
No way.
Better be paying attention, Doc. Give me
grace, bury my sins.
So Ernie can use this in the blooper reel.
That's right. We love you, Ernie.
Don't put that in, Ernie.
Quit taking yourself damn seriously.
Oh,